The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has reconvened. The Honorable Eugene G. Doherty presiding.
Good morning. The court is calling case number 4-24-1515, People versus Stephen Coleman. Would counsel for the appellant please state your name for the record?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Rachel Kinstrand, Office of the State Appellate Defender, Assistant Appellate Defender on behalf of Mr. Coleman.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honor. Adam Rodriguez for the People with the Office of the State's Attorney's Appellate Prosecutor.
Very good. Thank you both. Ms. Kinstrand, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court and counsel. I plan to address the first two arguments in the brief regarding the arson evidence and the historical cell site location testimony, but I'm happy to address any of the other arguments as well.
Before you do that, because it might affect whether you raise that argument, the relevance of the historical cell site information is that it could put the defendant's phone at the scene of the fire.
Well, the relevance of the historical cell site location data is that the way the state offered it is that it purported to suggest that the phone moved from where he was living to the Western Apartments. And as I attempted to point out in the brief, that's not actually what historical cell site location data does.
But
It
we know the phone was found at the site of the fire.
We do, but we don't know when the phone was placed there. And I think if you noted in the jury deliberations, they specifically asked for Detective Wickstand's testimony about the historical cell site location analysis that he purported to do through CellHawk in order to establish that the phone moved at a given period before the fire from A to B. And as I pointed out, again, it's not accurate to refer to historical cell site location data as the phone moving. It's really where the phone pinged off the tower, and a number of variables can affect that, including, the weather, how many towers are in the area, what the strongest tower is, et cetera. And
All right, go ahead.
okay. Yeah, and I'll focus on the first, the scientific, overall focusing on the scientific evidence in this case. As I pointed out, cases in this case, the witnesses, the two witnesses, Coleman's ex-girlfriend and his brother, had very questionable credibility, and the state relied very heavily on its law enforcement witnesses to support its case that Mr. Coleman committed arson. But numerous cases have reversed convictions or awarded new trials based on faulty arson evidence. The evidence that has been deemed faulty includes evidence that an arson occurred because of pore patterns, charring, holes on the floor that have in the past been used to claim that an accelerant was used. But as we know from subsequent scientific validation, those same observations can be caused by flashover, glowing combustion, or radiation.
Are you basing that based on your reference of outside material or evidence in the case?
I'm basing it on both. And I understand that in the appendix, I put a lot of material from the National Fire Protection Association manual. But I think in this case, because the Illinois Administrative Code in effect at the time relies on those materials, and because it was heavily testified to in this case by all of the fire evidence, so Investigator Poole, the deputy fire chief Detman, and the defense's own expert, it's of the record. And I will also point out there's a second district case, People v. Petrie, which I cited in the brief. It has to do with the shaken baby syndrome, and there's sort of a complicated issue of whether there was a lucid interval to support the state's theory of the case. And in that case, the appellant relied on, authority, outside authority, for the purposes of showing that counsel was ineffective. And so it's not as if I'm asking you to make a factual determination on outside sources. It's simply supporting my claim that counsel is ineffective. And certainly, I cited a bunch of cases, albeit from other jurisdictions, that have publicly called out this evidence. As far as raising this issue on appeal, I'm not sure how else I would do it. I mean, I don't feel like as an advocate for the defendant, I can't wait till post-conviction proceedings to raise it because all of the evidence has come through. And so the real purpose of explaining this kind of complicated issue is to just make sure that it's clear on exactly what the NFPA supports and doesn't support. And what the cases that have, resulted in overturning convictions and new trials for petitioners and defendants throughout the country have said about this evidence. So I do think it's fair game in his appeal. Indeed, I don't know how, I would really raise this issue without it. And of course, like I said, there's a case of People v. Petrie. It is a Second District Appellate Court case, but for the purposes of considering whether trial counsel was ineffective. I certainly don't believe it's improper for me to have cited that. So it's my long-winded way of trying to answer the outside source question. Again, this definitely.
You made a statement earlier that the state relied primarily on these expert witnesses who could only testify to the opinion that the fire was not caused by electrical malfunction or some other non-human related cause, that it was set. It was human caused. Really, isn't the bulk of the case the fact, and witnesses are always impeachable, and these two may be more impeachable than many others, but isn't the bulk of the case that your client told two people, according to them, "I'm going to go burn the building," is went into a car with one of the person who got a and he got a ride there with a gas can. At about the time the building then burned, and his cell phone is found there, and then he later says he had lost his cell phone, and then later says, he's nervous, and he says, "I am smoked. I'm in trouble." Isn't that a lot of evidence, even besides what the experts say?
I think those witnesses have so many credibility issues. I mean, I'm really struck by the state presenting Jesse Coleman, who purportedly hadn't been on speaking terms with his brother, yet comes at close to midnight, picks him up with a gas can, ostensibly drives him to the scene of what the state alleges is an arson. Drops him off and then testified he had no idea that his brother was going to set the building on fire. I mean, the whole the these witnesses are just, I don't obviously the record doesn't indicate why Jesse wasn't facing any charges, but the entire scenario that he testified to just has so many serious credibility concerns. I think it calls into question the recitation of what Coleman purportedly said. And that's why because these witnesses and then of course his drug addicted girlfriend, who was admittedly sober for a year by the time of trial, but nonetheless, had been doing drugs all day, had been at the scene of those apartments the day of and had gotten drugs. I mean, the whole scenario is so these witnesses are just they're not credible in the
I
claim
don't,
that they
yeah,
tore.
but they're there, and it's for the jury to decide the weight to be given to them.
It is, but if you took out the law enforcement testimony, that if you took out Paul and Detman, if you took out Paul specifically saying this was an intentionally set fire, And if you took out the observations that I counter Detman improperly raised about, being textbook and it being there being poor patterns and not, claiming it's not electrical, but without looking at all of the electrical systems, if you took that out and you just had these two witnesses and you had no gas can and you had no independent corroboration of these statements, I think you'd have a very different case. Even if you had poll testifying it to what I part of what I argued, which is none of this stuff showed was consistent with what we know are reasonably relied upon standards by fire
The
investigators.
jury heard that opinion.
Well, the jury heard that, but they heard Paul give an opinion that the fire was intentionally set. And what I've argued is that it's this, he testified that he would never testify for the defense. He was a law enforcement witness, and it would be inappropriate for him to testify for the defense. So it's like I liken it to a police officer that has investigated a case getting up there and saying the client is guilty. Because if he's not going to follow, if he's going to rely on discredited science, if he has no proof that an accelerant was used because there's no confirmatory testing, but
Which
yet he's
the defense expert said can happen because of the consumption of the accelerant in the fire and because of washing away any traces as a result of the extinguishing of the fire.
well, I believe that was Paul that testified to that. I don't know
And
that Fennell added
your
that,
client's expert agreed that that can happen, and he has seen it happen.
but he didn't agree with the methods used, the failure to validate the conclusions that Paul made that it wasn't electrical because the investigation was truncated. It wasn't a complete investigation, and he came up with a hypothesis that couldn't be validly tested, namely that the origins were there was two non-communicating fires, which Fennell disagreed with, and then testified if you don't have the origin correct, you probably don't have the cause correct, and pointed out on the exhibits where the fires could have communicated with each other, and then you have no accelerant, you have no proof of an accelerant. And so to give a scientific conclusion when you don't have a scientifically valid hypothesis that you can test, and then it's coming through from a law enforcement witness is just highly prejudicial. And I think People v. King, the Illinois Supreme Court case that dealt with the crime analysis, talks about that. Even, here you have you turn something into a battle of the experts that didn't need to be because counsel should have objected. Counsel had an obligation, even if she put on her own expert, she still had an obligation to understand this evidence and to sufficiently cross-examine on this and to make objections. Once the proverbial cat is out of the bag, it's very hard for her expert to overcome this improper opinion. So,
Yes, counsel, if I may, even if we would exclude poll, I guess my question is, what's the reasonable probability that would undermine the confidence in the outcome, that we'd have a different outcome?
well, the prejudice is so great. I mean, he doesn't have to, it doesn't have to be acquitted, but I mean, if you're having a fire investigator come up there and testify, yeah, this was arson. The proving the state's case basically. If you take that opinion out and then you take out some of these this faulty reliance on poor patterns or whatnot, I think you have a very different case. And you again, I also want to point out this is a
But wouldn't you
building.
still have with he called for the ride, he went to the scene, he made these statements, he had a gas can. Wouldn't that all still be present?
It will be present, but again, it's coming through witnesses that have such. The Jesse Coleman in particular is it's a very confusing witness to me, just because But
those would still go to the weight of the
would still go, but
the
it would be without this improper opinion. It would be without a law enforcement witness testifying that this was arson. It would be without you've got somebody, and I think the state was right to highlight this in closing argument, like in Detman and Poole to seasoned mechanics, but they weren't. They if you took this evidence out and you only had Carly Fishback and Jesse Coleman testifying, and you had no real eyewitness testimony, and you had evidence she had been at that apartment and had access to his phone, earlier that day, and then coupled with the fact that, this was a known apartment building to the police, and there had been a previous fire, and there was obvious just issues with this apartment building. I think it would have looked like a very different case for the jury. And of course, I'm not just talking about the arson evidence. I'm also talking about the historical cell phone data with which, the jury asked for. And
So
again,
if she set the fire and planted his phone, or if his brother did, cell phone data would look the same, right? I mean, it again, I'm trying to understand what impact the cell phone data has when all it can really tell us is maybe where it started, definitely where it ends up, and we know where it ends up. And the question is, did she bring it, or did he bring it? Coming from the same place, right?
well, I just don't think it should have been admitted at all. I mean, then if you want
But
to just
what's the
rely on
harm, is I'm trying to get at?
the
What's
well,
the concept?
the harm is that the state used it to establish the movement. That's the harm. I mean, Wickstand didn't have any
Movement of the
training.
phone. We know the phone didn't always reside at the apartments. We know it was found there at the end. We know, therefore, it had to move there. What is the cell phone data adding to that? We know it moved to the apartments.
But the argument is that it's not showing movement. It's not showing, it's showing the towers it pinged on.
Yeah,
Okay. And it's being
but we
used.
know there's movement. That's what I'm trying to say is, even if you're right, we know there had to be movement because it didn't start out there, but it ended up there.
Again, the phone using a police detective who has no training on historical cell site location analysis for the purposes of claiming that the phone moved X, Y, and Z and was dropped off there is prejudicial. You could have Jesse
No,
testifying
it
about.
could be improper. Whether it's prejudicial depends on its effect in the case. So, what was its effect in the case?
It was used by the state to try to establish that Stephen went from his house to the scene.
Well, that the phone moved
That the
from his
phone,
house
it
to the
was
scene.
that that well, I mean, that it was Stephen that it was Stephen's phone and that Stephen moved. That's how
I
the
know
state
that's a state theory, but the evidence just is tells us, according to the state, that the phone moved from Stephen's house to the scene. That's all it tells us. And we know that that had to be true because he had it, and then it was at the scene.
Right, but it's you rely they're relying on it to show when it got to the scene. I mean, that's
Well, do you think somebody planted it there ahead of the fire by a day or something? If
I
somebody planted it there, which now we're into the realm of speculation,
mm-hmm.
presumably they did it when they set the fire. So it would show the same thing. It would show it being put there at the time of the fire, unless your theory is that he coincidentally lost it there and sometime later the fire started.
Again, you'd have to you have to make a series of inferences that Jesse's telling the truth, that Coleman got in his car, that a brother he didn't talk to for years called him
No,
up and
I'm
got a
talking
ride.
about the cell phone data and what limited impact it could possibly have in this case. That a case where we know where the phone ended up, we know it didn't grow out of the ground there, and the theory for why somebody else would have put it there is that they may be trying to frame your guy, which is, of course, not supported by any evidence. But even if that were the theory, presumably they'd put it there at the time of the fire. So what have we gained? What relevance, or what prejudice is there from this information since we know all of that.
Well, I just disagree that you could allow a detective to testify to this locate that he came up with this location data and
Assume
it
you're
puts the phone
correct.
there at the
Assume you're
time.
correct.
Well,
Don't
then
you have
you
to show prejudice to make it reversible?
well, if you take but if you take his testimony out, you have just the phone being recovered at the scene. And you have the brother that lives 3 blocks away, and you have the girlfriend that has access to
Yeah.
it, and you have the girl, that's what you have. I'm trying to satisfactorily answer that
Yeah.
question based
Well,
on the record I have.
but he had the, I mean, it was his phone. The point that she would have been able to get at it means it was at their home, right?
Right. But you don't have a time of it being, you wouldn't have the time of it being placed, right? Without the historical cell phone data
Right.
saying it ping, ping, pinged,
Yeah,
you don't, you.
somebody placed it there 2 days before and then 2 days later set a fire. I mean, it just doesn't add anything to the case.
It may not accept that they were clearly doing business in terms of purchasing drugs from them. So it wasn't a building they were unfamiliar with. Again, the cell phone data, I don't want to get it
You can
in.
finish. Go ahead.
Yeah, getting in it's not any of this evidence in a vacuum, right? It's the arson evidence, it's Pohl's testimony, it's Detman's testimony, it's this historical, it's a case where how much bad science really is too much. And my argument is in a case where you have a defendant facing 3 life sentences, this evidence has to be scientifically valid. There has to be a proper foundation for it. And particularly when you weigh this against these two fact witnesses of questionable credibility, it is prejudicial and it is worthy of this court granting a new trial. And for these reasons, I'd ask that the court grant relief.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Rodriguez.
Thank you, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. Defendant did not suffer ineffective assistance of counsel from trial counsel's decision not to challenge the admission of the people's expert arson investigator. In this case, Investigator Pohl was properly qualified to testify as an expert under Illinois Rule of Evidence 702, and no legitimate basis exists to challenge the foundation of his testimony. Accordingly, counsel is not deficient in not in declining to raise a meritless challenge, and defendant cannot satisfy prejudice under Strickland. As to the issue of deficient performance, counsel did not perform deficiently. Investigator Pohl possessed the sufficient knowledge, training, and experience as required by Rule of Evidence 702 to offer an expert testimony. He lays that out abundantly in the record. It's clear that he has extensive training. So any attempt to challenge the foundation for his expert testimony would have been meritless. And as case law makes clear, and this court's well aware, counsel cannot be ineffective for failing to raise a meritless issue.
Well, could you address not just his qualifications, but whether his methodology was valid?
Sure. So one of the issues that defendant brought up a moment ago was this faulty presumption that the arson science is bad, and therefore all of the testimony or all sort of the basis of Investigator Poole's testimony is tainted by this sort of specter of propriety, impropriety, and faultiness. That's just not supported by the record at all. Investigator Poole testified he used a scientific method. That it conformed with the applicable national fire standards. He outlined in deep detail the basis for his opinion. And defendant's argument on this point really just seeks to cast this sort of conclusory claim that, oh, in other cases, fire science has been found to be faulty or there have been issues which led to defendants receiving post-conviction relief, what have you. But defendant fails to critically connect that to this case. So even under a charitable interpretation of defendant's argument regarding this claim about faulty fire science, defendant has to connect that to the investigation and the information that Investigator Pohl used to make the determination that this fire was incendiary set and intentionally intentionally caused. And defendant utterly fails to make that connection, as I think the colloquy with the court a moment ago shows. At most, defendant is able to cast these sort of aspersions and make references to information outside of the record, which, as this court, as previously stated in Dillard, is improper and impermissible to do. So there is no real basis in the record for the court to make that determination. And at most, the fact that Investigator Poole may not have engaged in any arc mapping or looked at electrical switches and things like that goes towards the weight that would be applied to his opinion, and not its admissibility. He absolutely had established the admissibility for the foundation of his opinion, and there's really no legitimate challenge otherwise. So in the face of that, counsel, attempted a strategy of claiming that the investigation was hastily formed and based on incomplete information. We know that strategy was ultimately unsuccessful. But as the appellate court said in People versus Faulkner, an unsuccessful strategy does not equate to deficient performance. Defendant brought up the Petrie case from the Second District to support his claim that counsel performed efficiently by not challenging the foundation of Investigator Poole. That case is plainly distinguishable. In that case, the appellate court found counsel was ineffective for failing to cross-examine one of the state's expert witnesses regarding the basis for his opinion that the victim had suffered an injury consistent with shaken baby syndrome, and that there would not have been a period of time after suffering that injury where the victim would have appeared fine and wouldn't have exhibited any sort of adverse symptoms or sort of similar issues of concern. In that case, the expert said it was his opinion on that point was based on information, principles generally accepted in the medical community. However, he did not say what those principles were, and he didn't identify any supporting information or documentation to substantiate that. And then on cross-examination, defense counsel simply asked the state's expert if he agreed with another doctor's testimony that the injury could have occurred several hours later, and the expert said he did. And it was sort of in that failure to really critically cross-examine the expert's foundation for his opinion on this point that the court found defense counsel had performed efficiently by not questioning the state's expert further about this disagreement or any basis for it in the medical literature. Unlike Petrie, Investigator Poole clearly laid out the foundation for his opinion that the fire was intentionally set and incendiary. And defense counsel's challenge for the basis of, and excuse me, defense counsel did challenge the basis for that opinion, both on cross-examination and through the defense's expert. Therefore, Petrie's distinguishable. But I say that all to say that this court needn't even address the issue of deficient performance because defendant cannot and has not established prejudice under Strickland. Assuming arguendo that the trial court erred in admitting Investigator Poole's testimony, the other evidence and reasonable inferences drawn therefrom inescapably prove defendant guilty. There is evidence of a defendant's motive, his anger over purchasing fake cocaine. There is defendant's statements to his ex-girlfriend and his brother indicating threats to burn down the Western apartments, thus indicating his intent to commit arson. There was evidence of his conduct, obtaining the red gas can from his Fishbach's home, calling his brother for a ride, and traveling to the scene of the arson with the gas can and being seen leaving his brother's vehicle with that evidence in hand. There was also the physical evidence of the defendant's phone found at the scene, further narrowing down his movements. There was also evidence related to defendant's post-defense conduct, his request for a false exculpatory statement from Ms. Fishbach that they were together the entire night when they were not, defendant's inculpatory statement to his brother following the arson at their mother's home that he was, quote, cooked. All of that information was evidence of consciousness of guilt, excuse me. Thus, defendant cannot establish that the outcome of the trial would have been any different, but for the admission of the challenged evidence. And that sort of argument also rings true for defendant's claim about the cell site location data. Even if it was error for that to have been admitted, there was direct evidence from Ms. Fishbach and from defendant's brother placing defendant directly behind the Western apartments. He was dropped off on Avenue I, which as the testimony established was directly behind that building. His phone was found at the scene. So to the extent that there was any error in the admission of the Verizon phone records or the testimony by Detective Wickstand regarding the historical cell site data, that was, you know, at most cumulative to the other evidence that established defendant's location on the night of the crime. You know, so therefore, defendant cannot satisfy prejudice under Strickland and related.
What about the argument the counsel's made that it added to the picture in terms of the movement of the cell phone? And it was used by the state to draw that picture of movement when the underlying data really wouldn't support it.
Sure. So I don't agree with that sort of characterization of the evidence, Judge. At trial, the historical cell site data was used to sort of merely indicate the defendant had been in the Sterling Rock Falls area in the 2 days leading up to the crime. Defendant's defense in part was based on identity, that no one could put him in the scene of the crime. So at most, the historical cell site data confirmed the defendant wasn't in Chicago or St. Louis. He was in the neighborhood. And more critically, the evidence that put him there was his brother's testimony that he drove him to the building and his cell phone being found at the scene. So even if this information about the historical cell site data placing him near the building, I don't think that's true. The people certainly made the argument in our brief that it placed him near, not that it established definitively he was at the address, since I'll acknowledge to my friend on the other side's point that historical cell site data doesn't establish a direct location, merely a generalized area. And even if you exclude that testimony of the historical cell site data, we have more direct evidence putting defendant at the scene of the crime. And defendant's sort of response to that is to raise credibility challenges, ask this court to reconsider issues of the witness's credibility. That was for the province of the jury. Defendant wants this court to also interpret his statements indicative of his intent to burn down the Western apartments in a light most favorable to himself, which this court is well aware is not the proper standard of review. Nor can this court make
counsel, if I can circle back a minute, though, and I know what your argument is that it helps place him, but really what the evidence showed is once again where the phone was and what the phone was the towers it was pinging from, correct?
Yes, absolutely, Judge. Okay. And so that's why, at most, that evidence was cumulative because we have Mr. Coleman's testimony directly putting a defendant in the scene of the crime, you know, a short time before the fire started. So at most, the testimony that it pinged off a cell phone and he was in a generalized area is cumulative to the more direct testimony that put him right at the scene.
If I could turn just for a moment, counsel, in a different direction, if you will, to, excuse me, Article 5, or I'm sorry, 584. And I guess I want to confirm, do you agree that the defendant's actions were part of a single course of conduct and there was no substantial change in his criminal objective?
I don't, Judge. So I think in regards to Section 5-8-4, under sort of the people's argument under the Supreme Court's issues in Terry, the appellate court's discussion in Foster, and the Supreme Court's issue in Tucker, or holding in Tucker, when you're looking at those cases and you're determining, you know, the consecutive aggregate maximum term allowed for those offenses, you look at the two most serious felony offenses, excluding natural life sentences, which in this case would have been defendants to Class X aggravated arson convictions. And so then you multiply what is the maximum sentence there under the analysis established in Tucker and Foster, which is 60 years times two, which equals 120. Defendant was convicted and sentenced to 105 years, which is therefore proper and within that applicable range. And one of the issues about
but counsel, I guess I'm going to go back to my question. You indicated that you don't agree with that statement. So do you not agree that it was a single course of conduct? What's the change in the objective? Help break that down for me, if you would.
Sure, I'm sorry. Yes, Judge. So in regards to that, and sort of broadly to defendant's point that I think he tried to make about this being a one-act, one-crime issue, is that residential arson deals with committing arson to the dwelling place. So there's a...
Well, can I interrupt?
Yes,
this
yes.
This is not a one-act, one-crime question.
Oh, I'm sorry, Judge. I apologize.
It is a different standard under the sentencing statute, and the requirement is that they were committed as part of a single course of conduct during which there was no substantial change in the nature of the criminal objective.
I see. I apologize, Aaron. I was a bit confused. Yes, I would not have any issue with that. This was certainly arson. There was no change. The fire that caused the damages to the dwelling, as well, caused the great bodily harm to the victim. But
Yeah, those were all the consequences, but the act was kind of one act, right?
correct, Judge. Correct. And so, in regards to that sort of analysis, I think Tucker discusses that you would sort of apply or not apply this aggregate consecutive sentence situation when there are separate incidences. And so that's sort of the rationale behind not allowing for an aggregate sentence. But in this case, it all kind of occurred and arose out of the fire. So.
So, is there any limit? You're saying the first degree murder is not, the life sentence does not enter into that math as being the most serious offense?
That's correct, Judge. That's what the Supreme Court said in Terry, and that's echoed in the Supreme Court's decision in Tucker, that a sentence of natural life is not the most serious offense for purposes of, in Terry, they were looking at Section 5-8-2 of the extended term statute, and there they interpreted it as applicable to the next most serious offense for which a defendant could be sentenced to a term of years, which in that case was coincidentally also. Two Class X arson convictions, I believe, and Foster applies that sort of calculation that's echoed in Tucker. So again, as I argued, it would be the Class X offenses. The most extended max would be 60 years times two, which equals 120, and defendant was sentenced to 105 years. So his sentence is proper and not in any way in violation of the aggregate extended terms that consecutive statute. So. Your Honors, I did want to, in the time I have left, discuss defendant's claim regarding the sensing issue in regards to the victim impact statement. Defendant cannot establish prejudice for the admission of the victim impact statement at sentencing because, as our Supreme Court explained in People versus Richardson, that held Section 9 of the Victim's Bill of Rights, which is based on Article 1, Section 8.1D of our Constitution, doesn't create a basis for vacating a conviction or granting relief when dealing with the admission of a victim impact statement. Defendant claims that the people read Richardson too broadly. However, our Supreme Court could not have been clearer when it said, quote, "Based on its plain language, Article 1, Section 8.1D specifically removes victims' rights from the spectrum of issues which a criminal defendant may appeal." That's Richardson at 231 of the opinion. Thus, defendants foreclosed from obtaining appellate relief on the basis of an otherwise legally permissible victim impact statement. Defense counsel was not effective for not challenging the victim impact statement either at the sentencing hearing or including such a claim in a motion to reconsider sentence, as that claim would have been meritless. Moreover, a defendant cannot show that the trial court improperly relied on the victim impact statement with imposing its sentence. The trial court, as the record shows, relied on defendant's escalating criminal history as established in the PSI, evidence of defendant's premeditation, which I think we've discussed, and the specific degree of harm suffered by the victims. Therefore, there was no basis to claim that it was necessary to object to the victim impact statement, and defendant cannot establish prejudice under Strickland in regards to this claim.
Can you
Separately,
tell me, without regard to prejudice, is there any part of the victim impact statements that you would concede was erroneously received?
erroneous received in what way, Judge?
Well, that had the objection been made, they would have been restricted in some way.
I don't. I know that defendant takes issue with the sort of presentation of the evidence and referencing, cries of agony. I certainly think that is an issue that perhaps counsel, private counsel who presented it wasn't familiar with how victim impact statements are presented. But this is an issue that's decidedly within the court's purview. Trial courts are presumed to know the law. They're presumed to accept and receive evidence for its permissible reason and to not consider improper or inflammatory evidence. Defendant has to establish that the trial court improperly consider that information at sentencing and point to something in the record. Defendant cannot and has not done that. The court, when laying out its reasoning for imposing the sentences it did, laid out everything that it considered, and defendants, or excuse me, private counsel's victim impact statement was not one of them. So there is no indication in the record that the court improperly considered this at all. And we certainly presume trial courts to know the law and to consider evidence for its proper admissible purposes and to exclude consideration of other things, absent some affirmative showing which defendant has not satisfied. I'll note finally for separately counsel's claim, or excuse me, defendant's claim that private counsel for Mertz and Mertz didn't qualify as a victim representative under the act. I think that's just plainly inconsistent and ignores, you know, the plain language of the act, which defines a victim's attorney under 725 ILCS 120/3G as an attorney retained to represent the victim and assert their constitutional and statutory rights. The select victims who were hired by private counsel chose to retain him so that he could represent a consolidated victim impact statement addressing all of their rights, and having the court consider that information in the totality of the information it considered at sentencing. That's absolutely proper. Defendant's argument that somehow counsel didn't fall within the definition, I think, is meritless. So, therefore, Your Honors, for these reasons, as well as those that people argued in our brief, we ask you affirm defendant's conviction and sentence if there are no other questions from the court.
All right, thank you, counsel. Ms.
Thank you.
Kinstrom.
Thank you. Just briefly, Your Honor. One of the points that opposing counsel made was that the faulty evidence that I identified with respect to the arson was not critically connected to Pohl's opinion. And I wanted to draw the court's attention to one of the quotes from Pohl's, which I cited in the brief. You know, he says he started with an open mind and began to eliminate certain things in order to, quote unquote, determine what a reasonable person would infer when you were given this particular set of circumstances and fire patterns and damage. And then, after ruling out spontaneous combustion, mechanical or electrical issues, he, quote, tried to come up with something. And at the end of this, I came up with the only solution that I could, the only logical reason for this fire, because I couldn't find any other reason for there to be a fire. Well, that's the authorities that I cited, and you know, the standards that are applicable to fire investigation. It's not to
Are
just
you
say,
talking about the NFPA 921?
well, I'm talking about using this, you know.
Right, but didn't your client's expert say that that is not binding or have the force of law?
Well, it's not just the NFPA, it's whether it's the type of evidence reasonably relied upon in the scientific community. They're presenting Pohl as an expert, and it's not. Deciding that you're using a process of elimination without having a scientifically valid testable hypothesis is not a foundation for an opinion that this fire was incendiary. And my point is that's how I connected it. It wasn't enough for counsel just to present an expert on this. She had to go a few steps further and say there's just no foundation for Pohl's conclusion that this is arson, because the stuff he's relying upon is not reasonably relied upon anymore. And I think that
Specifically, what is demonstrated to be not relied upon in courts as far as evidence of an incendiary origin? The burn pattern?
the burn patterns, the fact that the fire burns hotter if it's arson, all of the charring evidence, claims that it was not electrical without actually looking at all of the electrical systems in the building, the failure to rule out methane, which not only can be part of the sewer but can also occur naturally in the ground and can build up in a structure. There's just, you know, you can go down the list. I think I outlined it at several points in the brief, but it's just not, it would have been a different, you know, the conclusion, only valid conclusion here was undetermined. It wasn't based on everything Pohl testified to. It wasn't this fire was intentionally set. He just didn't have any proof of that. And you know, the la he can testify to what he observed, but he can't draw conclusions on it based on things that no longer are scientifically valid. And that was the same problem with Detman. You really have two law enforcement witnesses.
If I may interrupt you, though, if we take, even for the purposes of your statements right now, if we assume maybe that relates to the burn pattern and that it burns hotter if it's arson, I guess explain to me how the claim with regards to the electrical, though, has been debunked. I mean, that doesn't seem so much of the theory as you're suggesting there are other things you feel he should have looked at.
Well, I think you can't say it's not electrical by looking at that one. My understanding, based on the testimony, was he looked at that one outlet that shows up in the exhibits, and then the boxes. But that doesn't, you know, there's electrical outlets all the way through that building, and you had a unit in there that had started on fire, apparently from a stove, although I don't think they ever proved that. So it's not like this was a building, a pristine building without problems. It had problems. It had known issues. There was a prior fire. So, but the point is that it is critic. I did critically connect it. Coleman did critically connect the faulty reliance on this bad science to the conclusion that Pohl draw and argued that it was prejudicial. And I just briefly with respect to the lack of prejudice, the law enforcement testimony purported to corroborate Jesse Coleman. So it there wasn't anything to corroborate that Coleman actually made those statements. There wasn't anything independent. You really did have to rely on credibility. And for all the reasons I argued in the brief, these were incredible witnesses, and it was highly prejudicial in this case to admit this faulty science.
All right. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. It's been very helpful. We will take this matter under advisement and stand in recess.